everybody. Gather around. I'm here to give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. Why? I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government.
The government.
The government can.
The government can.
Good morning. You're listening to the Good Government Forum, the Thursday 1 hour edition. We're here this morning with the lovely, effervescent, and always charming and famous Angel DeFazio. It's Angel's show. Angel has a special guest she's lined up for an interview. I'm not exactly sure what she's going to be talking to a medical doctor about this morning. I think he's a medical doctor. But anyway, Angel, why don't you just take it away and we'll sit back and listen.
Okay. Thank you, Mon. Good morning. Today I'll be interviewing Dr. David Carpenter, and yes, he is a medical doctor. Now, normally I like to do a quick bio sketch on my guest, but based on today's show, his credentials really are extremely important on the topics we're going to be discussing, which are veterans, Gulf War syndrome, EMF, 5G, and the Internet of Things. Now, Dr. Carpenter got his BA from Harvard, and he was also awarded magna cum laude for his thesis. He was a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He got his MD from Harvard, and he was awarded cum laude for his thesis again. He also received the Leon Resnick Prize given to a Harvard Medical School graduate showing promise in research. He's had numerous awards such as the Jacob Javits Neuroscience Investigator from the National Institute of Neurological and Communicative Diseases and Stroke, also the Homer G. Calver Award from the American Public Health Association for Studies in Environmental Health, the Abion Bernstein Award in recognition of an expanding contribution to public health and the prevention of diseases through lifelong research of environmental health hazards, and the Rodney Wiley Eminent Visiting Fellowship at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. He's also a visiting professor of physiology both in Mexico and Japan. He's currently the professor, at Sony in Albany in Environmental Health Sciences School of Public Health, and the director for their Institute for Health and the Environment, along with being an honorary professor at Queensland Medical Research Institute. Now, some of his prior positions, either as the dean, director, or professor for neurophysiologists, the Laboratory of Neurophys at the National Institutes of Mental Health. He was the chair of Neurobiology Department of the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute Defense Nuclear Agency, director of Wadsworth Center for Laboratories and Research for the New York Department of Health, Institute for Health and the Environment at Albany. He was the dean of the School of Public Health at Albany. He was a research physician at Wadsworth Center for Laboratories and Research, New York, and an adjunct professor for the Center for Neuropharmacology and Neuroscience at Albany College. He's been either the editor-in-chief, advisor, academic, or editorial boards for cellular and molecular neurobio, environmental pollution, International Journal of Occupational Medicine and Environmental Health. He's been either a chair or a member of the U.S. National Committee for International Brain Research, Neuroscience Discipline Working Group, National Advisory for Environmental Health Sciences, state and local committees such as the Institute of Basic Research, Capital District Chapter for Alzheimer's and related disorders, Healthy School Network, Environmental Advocates of New York. He's had numerous federal grants, U.S. Air Force, NIH, Defense Nuclear Agency, National Institute of Environmental Health Science, the Superfund Basic Research, Exploratory Center on Minority Health and Health Disparities in Smaller Cities. Now, his research interests are exposures to persistent organic pollutants and the risk of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, cognitive and behavioral effects of environmental contaminants in kids, IQ, ADHD, and older adults, dementia, Parkinson's, ALS. He's had about 440 major peer-reviewed journal publications, 6 books, 50 reviews or book chapters. So as you can see, Dr. Carpenter's credentials are impeccable. He is a public health physician as opposed to being a practicing physician. So, welcome, Dr. Carpenter, to the show. Did I leave anything out regarding your background?
No, I don't think we have time for anything, any more discussion. That took so long. But thank you.
Okay. Our first topic today is one that my medical nonprofit has been expounding for well over a decade regarding Gulf War Syndrome, GWS, and how the so-called medical and allied health professionals are doing the veterans really a great disservice from their erroneous so-called evaluations, diagnosing, and treatment protocols by refusing to acknowledge that a large majority of Gulf War veterans are really chemically injured and need to be treated with the highly successful treatment protocols that are used by medical professionals who treat these patients. Dr. Carpenter, you just completed a federally sponsored grant issued by the Department of Defense as the principal investigator. I believe the title of the grant was called Gulf War Illness, Evaluation of an Innovative Detoxification Program. Can you please explain the genesis of this grant? Did it have anything to do with the findings of the report from November of 2008 entitled Gulf War Illness and the Health of Gulf War Veterans, Scientific Findings and Recommendations, Research Advisory Committee on Gulf War Veterans Illnesses.
Well, yes, it certainly had something to do with that National Research Council report. One of the problems with Gulf War illness is that in spite of many studies that have been done, nobody has really come up with clear understanding of what the cause was and certainly not what an effective treatment option is. There have been many trials that have been done and some have shown some improvement, but it's still pretty much unknown. Now, our project, which has been controversial, because what we have done is apply the Hubbard detoxification program, which has been controversial for a long time, but this is a protocol that's based on the assumption that there are some chemical contaminants that remain stored in the body for long periods of time. And in this case, the hypothesis is that during the 1990-1991 Gulf War, which was a very brief war, there were some unusual exposures that led almost 40% of the U.S. servicemen that were deployed in Kuwait at that war to have these chronic symptoms that are really disabling. The symptoms include fatigue, multiple aches and pains, a lot of problems with mobility, a lot of cognitive problems. And we were hypothesizing that there had been a chemical exposure that where the chemical still remained in the body. The hypothesis behind the Hubbard detoxification program, which has been used primarily for substance abuse people, is that this combination of exercise for 20 to 30 minutes, then prolonged multiple hours in a relatively low temperature sauna with increasing doses of crystalline niacin. Crystalline niacin is vitamin B3. It's very common. It's used and been used widely for many, many years. But while at low concentrations, crystalline niacin actually reduces serum lipids. With higher concentrations, it mobilizes fats from the fat stores in our body. And so the hypothesis is that if we have toxic chemicals that are stashed away in our body fat, that with application of heat and crystalline niacin, these will be mobilized from the fat stores and therefore they can be excreted and the body burden can be reduced. Well, our study, we've completed the data gathering results, and actually just this morning I've been working on the final version of the publication that we will be submitting for publication very shortly. What we did was recruit people that suffered from Gulf War illness or Gulf War syndrome, which has been well defined by the National Research Council and other groups, people that were seriously ill and that would be willing to travel to our site, which was in Annapolis, Maryland, and spend about a month there going into the sauna every day for something like 3 to 5 hours, and would take a series of tests that would be where we would determine the quality of life, how that changed over a period of time. We had blood samples drawn for clinical chemistries. And then we gave a whole series of psychological and neurocognitive tests. And we did this in multiple stages. Now, in the first place, it's very difficult when you have something so invasive as every day in the sauna for a month. You can't really have a control population. So what we did was we had a wait list control. So some of the people came in, they took all of the tests, and then we sent them home for a month and had them come back and take the tests again. And what we found is that there was no significant change in their performance on any of these tests just by repeating the assays. Then they and then the other group that were in our invention category, we took more blood samples, gave all of these tests before they went into the sauna. They stayed until the end point was not the same for each individual because we depended on increasing the doses of niacin. And niacin is well known to cause flushing and itching, but one accommodates to it after a while. And so when they accommodated to the highest dose that we used, which was 5,000 milligrams, then we considered that the detoxification program was over. We sent them home. 7 days later, we had them come back and repeat all of the tests. And then we sent them home again and brought them back 3 months later. What we have found is that there was very significant improvement in almost every one of the tests. Of the 36 tests that that we had, these the quality of life, the psychological and the neurocognitive tests, there was improvement in 29 of those tests, tested at 7 days after they came out of the sauna. And furthermore, although we lost some of the individuals for the three-month follow-up because many of the subjects in our study came from out of state, that there was no decrement in the improvement after 3 months. And for some of the measures, there was actually a continued improvement past that was in the 7 days. Well, we still don't have the analysis of the chemicals in the body. We ran out of money, and so we have blood samples stored and hope that we will be able to document that there really was a decrease in the chemicals in the blood. But clearly, that our study shows that from the point of view of people feeling better and also their brain working better, that this period of time improved their functioning. Now, can we say that this caused the functioning? You know, one of the things we're saying in our manuscript, if we all exercised every day and we had people fussing over us and we went to the sauna every day, just psychologically we would all feel better. But clearly, our Gulf War illness veterans were dramatically improved after going through this program. And no matter how it works, if this improves the quality of life, it then deserves to be used elsewhere.
It's very interesting. I'm hearing you talk about saunas. People who are environmentally ill basically are told to find a sauna. If you can't, is to get a gallon of water, drive your car, sit in a parking lot, and sweat to decrease the amount of toxins in the body. Now, you did mention the detoxification releasing the chemicals. Would you like to explain what the difference is between a lipophilic and a lipophobic chemical?
Yes. Lipophilic means you like fat. And so lipophilic chemicals are ones that dissolve in the body fat. And there are many that are like that. Many of the pesticides, the dioxins, the polychlorinated biphenols, the compounds that are called PBDEs, they're flame retardants, they are all very fat-soluble. And so we have stores of them in our body, but they're almost entirely in the fat. That's in the fat cells, but also in the fat that's in our blood. So they circulate, but they're in the fat. Now, other chemicals, especially salts, that includes a lot of metals and so forth, these are water-soluble, So when something is water-soluble, we say it's hydrophobic, or it's lipophobic. Hydrophilic means you like water. Hydrophobic means you don't. Lipophilic means you like fat. Lipophobic means you don't. So obviously each chemical, whether it's toxic or not, has got a certain amount of water solubility. Things that are water soluble tend not to be soluble in fat, and vice versa.
Okay, thank you. Now, did you, during your study, look into the association of environmental toxins and mitochondrial dysfunction leading to cytotoxicity? Because basically, a lot of mitochondrial conditions share common but non-specific symptoms, such as the fatigue and muscle pain, which a lot of people with chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia and environmental illness exhibit, which seem to be common with the Gulf War veterans.
Well, in our study, we did not do that, but other people have demonstrated mitochondrial dysfunction in Gulf War illness veterans. Now, it isn't that I've never studied mitochondrial function in relation to chemical contaminants, because I've, over the years, done a number of studies, but mainly with isolated cells, either nerve cells or immune system cells, where we look to see how environmental chemicals, and I've primarily studied PCBs and dioxins, but some other compounds, where we were able to demonstrate directly that these chemicals have adverse effects on mitochondria. The mitochondria are a major source. They store calcium, and when they lose their energy, they release the calcium, which is very damaging. And we were able to demonstrate that these chemicals directly damage mitochondria, resulting in elevations in calcium. But, of course, it's very difficult to do exactly that kind of study in a living person. But the evidence is quite consistent with that being a very important part of the cause of the syndrome.
Okay. In a perfect medical situation, how would you like to see the veterans' health concerns be addressed? Do you feel that the current level of evaluation and treatment plans are effective, including the automatic knee-jerk reaction to prescribing psychotropic drugs to what I claim are basically masking the symptoms rather than addressing the underlying causation and pathology?
Well, I totally agree with you. The tendency, and it's not just among veterans, but there's a great tendency for diseases in people where the symptoms are rather nonspecific. You have headaches, you're tired all the time, your brain doesn't feel like it's working very well. Many physicians, their first inclination is to send the person to a psychiatrist, and these are not taken seriously. They need to be taken very seriously because these are real diseases, and particularly in the veteran population where individuals, especially in war zones, are exposed to so many things that we as civilians are never exposed to. And they cause changes in the brain, in the body, that really have to be dealt with. Now, there's a fair bit of research on Gulf War syndrome and Gulf War illness, but there hasn't been any really significant development in treatment mechanisms that reduce the symptoms. The application of drugs that hide the symptoms, that's one thing, but to reverse the problem, that's where we are really stuck. There needs to be much more systematic research there. Now, I must say that for the Gulf War illness, there has, because of congressional action, there's been much more research than there has been on some of the other issues related to veterans. Veterans, after all of that they have given to the country, they deserve very, very active study and treatment of the symptoms that they come home with.
Do you think that the current protocols with throwing the psychotropic drugs is more like a protective, umbrella, so that the government has no culpability in exposing our veterans to all these neurotoxic chemicals when they were in the battle?
Well, yes, I think that's true. The psychotropic drugs basically mask a lot of the symptoms. Now, is it a great conspiracy? I'm not sure I would go that far, because I think that the people in our veterans' hospitals are trained, are concerned, they're anxious for the best treatment of the veterans. But the resources to really get to the causes of these diseases, those are very limited, and that's where we really need to have more action.
Now, to me, the most important recent medical discovery was back in June of 2015, when a Dr. Kupferis, a neuroscientist, and his team at the University of Virginia showed that there was a direct correlation with the gut lymphatic system and the brain. Now, given the fact that the veterans were exposed to chemicals while serving, along with the food they were served, could there possibly be a correlation between potential leaky gut syndrome in association with the chemicals that can cause neuroinflammation that compromise their blood-brain barrier, which in turn cause some neurological changes in the brain? Because we know that once you inhale the chemicals, there's really no filtering after inhalation, and it's registered through the olfactory neurons, epithelium, etc. And could that be causing some of the psychological issues?
Well, absolutely. This has been a very exciting development in the understanding in the last few years how that the bacterial profile that we all have in our gut, particularly the large intestine, has major impacts on health. And furthermore, that even a relatively brief exposure to something that changes the profile of the different species of bacteria in the gut can have long-term health consequences. It hasn't been studied so much. I'm not aware of any studies in Gulf War illness, but for example, it's now fairly clear that some obesity is, which we have real epidemics in the whole country, in the world for that matter, but some forms of obesity are because of a profile of bacteria in the gut that metabolize food much more efficiently, and therefore the host gets fat from it. There are now protocols for treating people that have abnormal bowel profiles of bacteria by even doing fecal transplants from a healthy person, and these change the health of the recipient in quite a significant fashion. Now, I don't think this has been applied very much to the study of toxicant exposure yet, but it's an area that deserves attention, and it's a wildly exciting area of research. People have shied away from dealing with the contents of our large intestine, but it turns out that these are very important for understanding the health of everybody, the immune system, the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, all depend on and relate to the profile of microorganisms in the gut.
Okay, I can go on for hours on this topic alone, but we don't have enough time right now. So let's get into Aura, the mutual interest, EMF, ionizing, non-ionizing radiation, 5G, and the Internet of Things. Now, you were the co-editor of the Bioinitiative report that really started the awareness of the EMF issue, along with being associated with the Committee on Electric Energy Systems of the Energy Engineering Board, the National Research Council. You were on the advisory panel for the Electric Energy System Division, U.S. Department of Energy, Committee Number 79, National Council on Radiation Protection and Measurement, the New York State Power Lines Project and Renewable Energy Task Force, Connecticut Academy of Sciences and Engineering Committee on Electromagnetic Field Effects. Now, before we begin, can you define the difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, EMF, and RF, and where they can be found?
Well, let's limit our discussion to electromagnetic fields, because there's also ionizing radiation that has particles, and we're not going to talk about that. But electromagnetic fields, the one that we all know best is visible light. So electromagnetic fields are waves of energy, but they don't have any mass. The reason you can distinguish red from blue is that they have different wavelengths, and therefore we have cells in our retina that can detect these small differences in wavelengths. Well, the electromagnetic spectrum goes at the low end from very low frequency radiation. And what we have known and studied most are the electromagnetic radiation that comes from the use of electricity. And this you have around power lines, you have around every appliance. In the U.S., our electricity is 60 hertz. That means 60 cycles per second. The waves move up and down 60 times a second. Now, if you go higher than that, and I should say that 60 hertz is non-ionizing because there's not enough energy there to directly damage DNA. If you go at higher frequencies, you come to the radio and television frequencies. And above that, you have the microwave frequencies for cell phones, for microwave ovens, for radar, for 5G. And then on up from that, you come into the infrared radiation. Now, without the heat that comes from the sun, which is electromagnetic, obviously life on Earth wouldn't be possible. And above the infrared, you have the visible light, which, again, is essential for life on Earth. Then above that, you have ultraviolet. Now, that begins to get to the point where there can be enough energy to directly damage DNA. Above ultraviolet, you have the ionizing part of the electromagnetic spectrum. These are X-rays and cosmic rays and gamma rays. Now, I think everybody knows that too many X-rays increases your risk of cancer. X-rays are very beneficial medically because you can visualize various parts of the body in a non-invasive fashion. But X-rays do have enough energy so they can directly harm DNA. And therefore, people exposed to too many X-rays have elevated risk of cancer. So the difference between ionizing and non-ionizing is whether there's sufficient energy to directly damage DNA. What we're finding out now that is really new information is that some of the, or probably all of the non-ionizing forms of radiation have enough energy to generate free radicals or reactive oxygen species. And while there's not enough energy to directly damage DNA because they generate these reactive oxygen species, they can indirectly damage DNA. So the distinction is not as clear as we used to think it was.
Oh, okay.
But I think I should say one other thing, because we certainly don't think that visible light or infrared is harmful. And that's one of the reasons why many people have the prejudice that if those forms of electromagnetic fields aren't harmful, then there can't possibly be any harm with something that has lower energy. And in fact, we're finding that is simply not true.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, do you believe all the propaganda and rhetoric that EMF emissions from smart meters are so negligible and that people are just overreacting regarding the health impact?
Absolutely not. I don't believe that those emissions are negligible at all. And I know personally enough people that are made physically ill if they're too close to their smart meter. And that actually includes my wife. We have a smart meter on our house, which I didn't even realize was there until long after it had been installed. And my wife keeps finding that she gets ringing in her ears if she sits too long on the inside of the house, next to where the smart meter is on the outside of the house. Now, ringing in your ears is not something that's terribly disruptive to your life, but it's a common finding in people that have smart meters. I've talked to too many people that didn't even know a smart meter was put on their house and then found suddenly they have fatigue, headaches, can't sleep at night, and if the smart meter is taken off, these symptoms go away. So The radiation from a smart meter, like almost any other source, falls off with distance. So certainly if you're a certain distance away, you're not going to have much exposure. But if you're close to the smart meter, you can have significant exposure. And the forms of those electromagnetic fields from smart meters are unusual. They're very brief but very high, intense, rapid pulses of electromagnetic fields. And smart meters appear to be unusually damaging to people's health. We don't know exactly why, but we think that it is likely this very rapid on and off at very high intensity that causes the body in some way to respond very negatively, probably through the generation of these free radicals or reactive oxygen species.
Okay, Angel, we have 14 minutes left. 13 minutes left, Angel.
Okay. Dr. Carpenter, I sent you a research grant from UNR here. It was their final performance report from 2008 entitled Non-Lethal Weapons, the Use of Radio Frequency Microwave Energy for Stunning and Immobilization, and the funding came from the U.S. AK Office of Scientific Research. What was your impressions of that report?
Well, that report basically showed that you can immobilize somebody by directing a beam of radio frequency radiation at them. And the hypothesis was that there are certain cells in the body called chromaffin cells that contain active ingredients like serotonin and histamine, and that you get a release of these chemicals from these particular cells, which generate a lot of heat. So these people suddenly are in great pain, but they're not killed. Well, I think that, you know, those people that say that that non-ionizing radiation is harmless should read this report. Excuse me, it's very clear that it can cause real harm.
There was an Israeli research study presented at a conference that the same electromagnetic frequencies used for crowd control weapons actually form the foundation for 5G, and that with 5G, they'll basically put together 50 billion devices under the guise of the Internet of Things. Now, from what I've read, that these wireless frequencies are in the millimeter and submillimeter range, confirms that these waves actually interact directly with the human skin, specifically the sweat glands. So, is this interaction actually causing the sweat gland ducts to act like helical antennas when exposed to these wavelengths? Is this what our future holds?
Well, there certainly are people that have put that forward as a hypothesis. I think it's not absolutely proven yet. But let me say something about 5G. This is an enormous threat to mankind. And it's not just in the U.S. it's being rolled out. It's around the world. The 5G is, as you said, it's millimeter wave. So these are the highest frequency in the non-ionizing spectrum. But they don't travel so far. So there's going to have to be a mini cell tower put in front of about every fifth to seventh house in urban areas, mounted on light poles or telephone poles or whatever. And it's going to be that you can't walk down any sidewalk without being continuously exposed to these millimeter waves. The houses on the side of the street where these little cell towers are located are going to be continuously exposed. And we have all of this evidence already showing that cell phone use increases the risk of brain cancer, and that excessive exposure to radio transmission towers increases the risk of leukemia, that wearing a cell phone in your belt reduces sperm count in men, putting it in your bra increases the risk of breast cancer in women. In addition to the whole issue of that subset of the population that are so sensitive to these frequencies that they become ill, very much like the Gulf War illness, headaches, fatigue, your brain doesn't work right. This is a very serious threat to people. And the benefit is only to the utilities that are making a pile of money on this. It has to be stopped. How we stop it is not clear, but it has to be stopped.
Okay, Angel, 8.5 minutes.
Okay, one last question, Doctor. What I feel is the most egregious assault on public health is all these stupid smart baby devices where they're actually creating wearable socks, or they're putting a band around the baby's ankle. Smart diapers. They even have a pacifier. So if parents are so stupid, and I'm not being facetious, I'm being honest, that they can't go in and check their baby's diaper, and they're really into high tech, do you think the cumulative effects of all these Wi-Fi and wireless devices are really going to be creating a generation of disabled people?
Well, absolutely, yes, I do. The problem here is that for most people, they are not at all aware of the possible dangers that come from excessive wireless exposure. Now, like any other thing that causes cancer or causes other harm. What we believe to be the case is what's important is our aggregate total exposure over periods of time. And furthermore, that infants and even the fetus before birth are the most vulnerable members of our society. So putting wireless devices on children, in my judgment, is absolutely obscene. There is no excuse for doing it. You're harming your child. You always look at risk and benefit. People think about this being beneficial, but they are oblivious to the risk, and the risk is significant. There's evidence that excessive exposure to Wi-Fi reduces the intelligence of a child, in addition to causing blatant symptoms like those of electrohypersensitivity, and increases risk of cancer in the future. So those things, one's got to look at modern technology with a certain skepticism. Of course, we all benefit from technology, but we should use it in with a reasonable amount of attention to the harmful effects as well as the beneficial effects. We're not going to go back to a pre-wireless age. Nobody's advocating that. But wired connections don't have any exposure. And going in and check to see whether your baby needs its diaper changed should be done anyhow, because the infants develop best with a lot of personal attention, not just being wired up to some device that tells you when the diaper needs to be changed.
Okay, five and a half minutes, Angel.
Okay. Dr. Carpenter, I'll let you close. What do you want people to get out of our conversation today? Take it away.
Well, I think the major thing I hope people will get is understanding that there are hazards resulting from wireless technology that need to be known about, understood, and that one can safely use wireless technology in moderation. But to uncritically do wireless everything is detrimental to health. You know, I think that we've all been bamboozled by industry that makes a lot of money by selling devices that we don't need and that actually cause harm. Certainly, it's very convenient to be able to use your cell phone wherever you go. But remember that if you use a landline, there's no exposure whatsoever. Now, landlines are slowly going away. And with the advent of the Internet of Everything, we see the country going to much greater exposure to wireless electromagnetic fields, non-ionizing electromagnetic fields, with little attention and little knowledge by the ordinary person of their risk of developing adverse health effects from that. You know, one should educate yourself about how strong this evidence is. Now, you know, certainly there are many questions that are not totally answered. But blindly going and thinking that just because something has been approved for sale and use, it must be safe, that's simply not the case. And the best solution is for people to be informed, then to make judgments. You can enjoy the benefits of modern wireless technology without being overtaken by them and overrun and being uncritical in the magnitude of the use. That would be my major advice.
Okay, and what about for veterans?
Well, we need to understand the basis of the diseases that we see in veterans. The Gulf War illness has been studied probably more than a lot of the other things, but, you know, we have all the PTSD in veterans. We have all the psychological trauma that comes from being in places where people are being killed right and left, having your own life being very threatened. And we need to find ways beyond just giving people a pill to help them deal with these, recover from the injuries and the illnesses that they have. Many of these veterans have been breathing in very dangerous things from burn pits, from pesticide and chemical residues, from depleted uranium, things that the rest of us are not exposed to any great degree. And we have to take seriously the reports, even when we don't quite understand what the disease truly is, as is the case with Gopher illness. What really caused it? And is it a maintained toxicant in our body? Or is it that there was some particular harm at the time of exposure, perhaps harm to the immune system or harm to the nervous system, from which there has not been a recovery? But we have to know about this, and we have to take action.
Angel, we got a minute. Hello? Angel?
Well, perhaps I can close.
Okay, go ahead.
I think that we have many threats to our health in the environment. That the threats to veterans, the threats they had during their deployment, are particularly dangerous and unique. But they're threats to all the rest of us also, from chemicals in our food, in our air, in our water, from exposure to ionizing radiation, to exposure to these radio frequency radiations, and we need to find ways to reduce our exposure.
Thanks, Doctor. It's been very interesting for the last hour. I'm sure Angel will be getting back with you. I'm sure she'll probably schedule another interview. Anyway, folks, continue listening to the Good Government Forum. Angel always has interesting, informative, and enlightening guests. I really appreciate it. Anyway, we'll be back with you tomorrow morning on Friday with the great Alex Newman talking about in our grand tour of the Middle East and as we visit the country of Syria. So we'll talk to you later.
It makes it all taste good.
Makes it all taste good.
And I feel so good, 'cause